All right, let's go ahead and go. It's straight up at 4 o'clock. Thank you all for being with us today. This is our November 13th, 2018 Ogden City Council meeting. This is our 4 p.m. joint work session. So let's go ahead and start through our agenda. We have the first thing on our agenda is to review the agendas for the next two meetings that we have. The city council, special city council meeting at 6 o'clock, and then immediately following the RDA, the redevelopment agency meeting. So just for your information, the special city council meeting was noticed just to offer an opportunity for any comment that might be appropriate following our discussion that we're going to have here in the joint work session concerning the mayor council discussion. We will introduce that in the next meeting, of course, but we did want to make sure that the purpose for this meeting is clear. There have been many citizens as well as council members that have asked for answers concerning the military drill that happened a little over a week ago. We, council leadership, have had a presentation by the administration, and we wanted to kind of duplicate that for you. It was informative, and I thought it was enlightening to get that information, so we're trying to provide that opportunity. During the, we are going to hold firm to our civility statement that's in our norms, so no personal disparagement of people will be tolerated for that. So any questions or concerns about that meeting? Okay.
Just to add a couple things.
Yeah, but go ahead.
We are being asked to share the recording of the work session, which is we're fine to do, obviously. It's an open session. So everybody, if you're speaking, make sure you speak clearly and into the mic. Be mindful of chewing and wrappers.
Speak in, eat out.
I'm told that the audio equipment is very sensitive, so let's just be mindful of that moving forward. So thanks, you guys.
Okay, the next, yes, ma'am.
I might also be, just remind, because we do have some guests here that may have not attended the work session before.
All right.
We do not take public comment or questions during the work session.
That's right. Thank you for bringing that up. That is one of our norms, which is kind of why we put the next meeting in on the agenda, as for any necessary public comment. Okay, following that meeting, we will have our redevelopment agency meeting. There is one item on there, the 1775 Washington Boulevard report from the administration. Do you want to talk about that one at all?
Just briefly, what's proposed is that the board adopt a resolution that would authorize the executive director to execute an assignment and assumption agreement with Mountain America Credit Union. Essentially, that agreement will authorize the city to take over the purchase option on that property and then to purchase that property. There's also included in that resolution authorization for billboard removal and relocation agreement. There is a billboard at 1825 Washington that will be relocated to 1775 Washington, the property that the city would be purchasing. And there's several parties to that agreement, and this is just agreement that they'll all be signing so that everybody can rely on what everybody's promised that they said they would do verbally. It basically just documents the verbal agreements.
Okay, we had a work session on this 2 weeks ago. Many of these things were included in that. This gives some detail to the broad discussion that we had 2 weeks ago. Any concerns about that or questions? Okay, and that's our redevelopment agency meeting. So let's go ahead and get on the next item, which is our council mayor discussion. The mayor is with us today, and who'd you bring with you? Anybody?
We got a crew in the back, but this was
okay.
At the end of the day, so we've asked to not have the same volume of people. So
okay.
I'm here to answer any questions that come up and give a timeline and everything else. I think we gave.
Well, the way we've listed it on our agendas is kind of the timeline. I think would be good. The way things kind of rolled out. Why don't you start there and we'll kind of go from there. Does that sound good?
Sure. I've got some bulleted points I'll go through in terms of timeline and contacts, and then we're willing to open it up for anything at the end of that. So on July 12th, a contracting company for the U.S. Army called F3EA contacted our economic development group and asked to use a vacant building for a military exercise. They do about 15 of these a year all over. These are the people that go in and take care of embassies or people that have been caught in overseas, forward-facing environments. They need an urban environment to prepare the military for these activities overseas. F-33A wanted to use the Swift building originally. They saw that. They've seen pictures of it. They thought that was representative of a lot of the environments that they would go into. But we didn't feel that was viable due to environmental issues. You guys have heard a lot about some of those environmental issues, and so we directed them away from that. The Hostess building across the street was their next choice, but that had been scheduled for demo and cleanup before the scheduled exercise, and the IGA building was the remaining option. On July 17th, CED and Legal contacted F3EA with questions about potential community impact in terms of noise and what to expect, everything else. What we were given was that F3EA indicated activities would primarily be inside. Exercise would take place just soon after sunset, and residents would be notified 24 hours prior by door-to-door and reverse 911. F3EA initially indicated that they would not use aircraft. I think it's worth saying at this point we do probably a training session a month just to, you know, for SWAT or our police department or anything else, so this didn't seem out of any of what we would have expected with a training exercise or a drill. On August 14th, we had a conference call with F3EA, PD, CED, and Legal. F3EA proposed use of a helicopter for the exercise. City staff agreed at that time and provided F3EA to coordinate with Ogden Police Department to minimize the impact and notify residents at that time. Not at that time, but within the 24 hours before the event would take place. On September 4th, F3EA met with PD to discuss the scope of activities and walked through the IGA building with them to make sure it would meet their needs and they could provide a safe and functional environment for their training. That would take us to September 13th. City staff and F3EA finalized land use agreement for the IGA building. October 26th, the contracting company notified city staff that the exercise was scheduled for 10 p.m. on November 2nd. On November 1st, CED confirmed that the contracting company would ensure that notification took place. That obviously didn't happen. On November 2nd, OPD sent notification about exercise through code red. Because it did not qualify as an emergency, notification only went to those who opted in. In an emergency, it's worth stating that all mobile phones using cell towers in the area would have been received an alert through a federal system called IPAWS. So it's a lot different than just a training session. So in a real emergency, every phone, cell phone in that entire area would have been pinged. But that's federally mandated. It's not locally requested. So we could send that through for a training exercise, but the federal people that would be in charge of that would have said, no, this isn't an actual emergency. We are not going to allow you the use of IPAWS. They're very nervous about making sure that people don't get desensitized to too many pings and everything else. I mean, I'm sure all of us in this room have received Amber Alerts and some of the other things that come through that IPAWS system. They didn't feel this met the level of any kind of big notice, so we weren't able to access that. Dispatch was notified that evening so they could share the info with callers. This is just a drill. Please don't be alarmed. You know, we want to keep the community and environment safe around the area. OPD initially planned to publish notifications on social media, but grew concerned about controlling the scene and decided not to publish. They were originally supposed to come after sunset, then it moved to 10, and then it got pushed, and they were just nervous about putting too much information out and having a scene that when some of that came in, they just didn't want anybody to be in harm's way at all. So they elected at that point not to push all of the public information out, which I think we all agree at this point was a mistake on our part. OPD learned on short notice that the start time for the exercise needed to be delayed. Exercise started at 12:30 and lasted about 45 minutes. There are a lot of mistakes and lessons learned, as we've shared and we've pushed out in letters to the community. The contracting company did not follow through with their initial assurances to minimize impact and notify area residents, which was a big miss on everybody's part. We should have been more diligent in making sure that that actually happened. They just said, well, the reverse 911 was one of the things we talked about, so we didn't put any boots on the ground or knock any doors. At this point, we collectively have agreed that we would have put people on every single block and then in front of every single door the entire time. 24 hours notice is what they gave us. That's what they agreed to do. They didn't do any of that work, and in the future we would make sure that anything we're doing in an area that might cause disruption would be boots on the ground and people in front of doors. But it's worth saying as well that one of these activities will not happen in a residential environment ever again. We had no idea the scope of what was coming in, and so it was, I think, as we mentioned and talked about in our leadership meeting, CED looked at it, legal looked at it, OPD looked at it, administration looked at it. When you looked at everything that was presented, it did not seem to be of this scope or scale. So in the future, we've learned that that's something we'll take very seriously and work hard to drill down and certainly minimize community and residential neighborhood impact.
Can I ask a question? I don't want to interrupt if it'll mess up the flow, but is there anything that we can do to follow up with that contractor about how the scope went beyond what they originally described?
Well, we can chase after that. They were initially kind of upset that I produced this big letter of apology to the community, but at the end of the day, they didn't fulfill a lot of what they had promised to do.
Yeah, I was just curious. I mean, is there any repercussions
So can we go sue or make some noise? I don't know that that's going to get anything accomplished. We've looked at options, but there's really not a lot there. The contract was written vaguely enough that, well, we may do some of this and may do some of that, and that's been a big lesson learned from a lot of us is, no, we need to have every single bit of that spelled out and not have any surprises, because we all collectively felt surprised at the end of the day for what happened and the scope and the scale. So we can go try to sue the federal government or the contracting agency. My opinion is that I think a lot of these contracting agencies are the lead groups that come in, put all the contracts in place and everything else so the Army can come in, but that at the end of the day, it's not necessarily the federal government you can go after.
Right,
it's the contractors that are in front of us.
I was just curious if there was any form of action.
Yeah, well, we've looked at that, and we continue to look into it, but it was vaguely written enough that we don't feel like there's a whole lot of teeth there, other than huge community-wide disappointment, and we've produced a whole bunch of information that they're not happy about. But if a contracting company performs like that, we're happy to not be contracting with a company like that in the future. So that's kind of where we came out on a lot of that.
I have a couple questions, but I wasn't sure if you will finish with your statement first, Mayor, and we should wait.
I can ask questions as we go.
Is that okay? Okay. So, actually, my question was along the lines of what Angela just asked, and I think you just actually answered. So you said that one of the options with this contractor could be obviously not to do business with them again. Not sure why would they be upset because you wrote a letter of apology or you wrote a letter to the public explaining what happened, but I don't know if you can have anything to say about that.
They haven't talked to me personally about it. My opinion on that is that they contract with the U.S. military. If they don't fulfill what their expectations are in those communities that they're working with to provide training opportunities, then they look like a bad performer, and it reflects poorly on the U.S. military. The U.S. military doesn't want to have you know, negative impressions or a negative experience in the community. They hire contractors to go in and to do all that work. I mean, even if you just look at Hill Air Force Base, for example, I think they've got about 4,000 active military and 21,000 contractors. And so they want and rely on people to go in and create these deals and these scenarios and these opportunities, and they rely on them to keep the public opinion in high regard.
I hope that, first of all, thank you for writing the letter that you wrote. I think that was very important for the community. And I can only speak for me, as you know, but anything that we can do to hold the contractors accountable for not fulfilling what they said they were going to do in the contract and for sort of being somewhat deceiving, because that's what it sounds like to me that happened. You know, please, I guess, see me as in my 1/7 of a role that I play here as an ally to do that. And I really honestly mean that.
Well, and I appreciate that. And we've looked at options to do that too. The original contract was no aircraft just after dusk. We'll hit every door in that whole area 24 hours before anything happened. And a lot of things that they had talked about just frankly didn't happen. And I think collectively we all want to be supportive of the military.
Of course.
So when you look at it on paper, it Absolutely. Didn't rise to a level of panic or hysteria on any single bulleted point that they talked about.
Yeah.
But when it came together and they were late and they didn't hit the doors and they didn't do a lot of the things that they promised, then it was very disruptive, and we're really upset about that. And I was more than happy to jump on the sword for that, saying, hey, there is a letter of apology that needs to go out to the community that was disturbed and scared and frightened, and that was never the intent.
Yeah.
Everything was to happen indoors just after dusk. They work with our law enforcement. I mean, those are things that we do on a regular basis that make us better. When you drill, you understand and figure out where your weaknesses are, and this was meant to be a drill where we could go in and work with some other agencies. If something big did happen, we could kind of figure out how we communicate and how we talk together and how we work together. This didn't turn out to be what happened at the end of the day.
Mayor, I think when you were talking, you mentioned something. I heard something about that later. They came and said something about the use of a helicopter.
Yeah.
So in the contract said no aircraft, but before the exercise happened, they did say they were going to use a helicopter?
When we asked them about community impact, they said they didn't foresee the use of any aircraft immediately. And that was where we were all kind of like, okay, well, that. And inside a vacant building that doesn't have a lot going on there, that doesn't raise any alarms. They did say later. And as you talk to some of the people that work through this, they kind of come in and they secure the location, work with the police department and everything else. But then when they're on site, they try to figure out what's the best training scenario for them. So they don't come in with a training scenario that here's exactly what we're going to do at this location. They secure the location, say here's what we want to have happen. Here's we want to have the drill and have the city support to do that. But then 2 or 3 weeks in front of that, they send in a whole bunch of logistics people and try to craft the best scenario for that environment. And at that point, that's when the aircraft came in that they would go in and do fast ropes with some people. That didn't ever hit my desk. Still, we're kind of running on these were some promises made, and this is what we were thinking about. And nobody on any level through the entire group felt like what they had given us raised the level to, you know, hey, we really need to pull this back off the table and reconsider it, because they do craft those scenarios after they come in and they have, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of advance notice. Even though they talked to us in July, once they get on site and on scene, that contracting company said, I think this is going to be the most robust training scenario for this location and the people. And so still at that point, we're operating under the idea that there would be no aircraft in the area. And it was still going to be after dusk, just after dusk, and they were still going to go and knock all those doors and do all those community notifications.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly what came in, that was never given to any of us. So we might have a helicopter support, we might do, you know, something like that. And then it turns out later that when you talk to some of the military people, they say, well, aircraft means fixed wing. Rotary aircraft is another. We all looked at it as like aircraft is aircraft. If it flies, it flies, and that's the kind of a blanket overreaching statement. If they say no aircraft, then we expected no aircraft. And now they say, well, no, aircraft means fixed wing, like a C-130 flying overhead or something. That's not how any of this came across through any of our groups. Like I said, legal, CED, everybody reviewed every one of these and felt like, well, yeah, we want to be supportive, and this helps train our guys too. So let's see if we can find a way to make that work. But aircraft didn't come to the table. They talked about it a little bit on a department director meeting, saying they might have some helicopters that would come in, but never a double axle, huge helo that would come in at 12:30 in the morning and everything else. So we were all scared to death when all of that happened. And I'll just say, I got a handful of text messages on Saturday morning right after this. And I was like, wait, what? That's not what we heard at all. And Rich and Angela and Ben can all attest to that, because this was supposed to be something that basically happened inside a closed, vacant building and was going to have a very minimal impact on the community. So had we known the scope and scale, then we would have said, absolutely not, that's not going to happen. We just kind of felt like we didn't know the scope and scale of it. So that's why we did all of our research, came in first thing, and Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we did nothing but meet about who knew what and when and where did we miss on recognizing some of what may have happened in that community. And that's Wednesday was a little bit late to get that information out, but that's what we had at the time, and we didn't want to release misinformation. And there's a lot of rumors and some other things going around, and we thought, before we push anything out officially, we need to actually understand what happened. And so we published everything that we understood that happened, all the documentation and everything else that we had. It took us a couple of days to gather it all, because you had multiple departments, multiple people that were working on it, but we felt like we needed to take the time to really understand what happened and push that out to the public. And it was as a letter of apology from us, not necessarily as a press release or anything else, because we did feel terrible for what the confusion that had happened and the misinformation that we felt we had and that we didn't have to provide to the community. It won't happen again, but if it did, we learned a lot from it. That's part of the reason I've told Rich this a couple times. You drill to identify weaknesses in the system and find a way to go in and fix those and improve on them.
Mayor, was OPD our contact person with this operation? Were they the ones that were overseeing this, or was someone else?
CED originally got the phone call. Okay. And said, well, we think we could find a place for it, but they worked in conjunction with OPD to say, can we secure the area? And so OPD was there to, you know, be on the corners and make sure nobody kind of walked into that drill or anything else. There's a lot that can go wrong if you have somebody that wanders into an environment where you've got a really intense drill going on and they don't understand what's going on. So OPD secured the environment, but the contracting company and the military are the ones that conducted the drill. So our job was to secure the environment around it and make sure that no public people or citizens were put in harm's way.
So if there were delays, who would say, this is get out of our range, we need to cancel the operation? Who would have that responsibility?
Well, it would have been one of the police captains that was overseeing it that stayed late. Ultimately, that would go to Chief Watt. Unfortunately, he was out of town for that, but it goes to the captain that was given the responsibility on scene to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
And I was a little curious about who, because actually the first thing that got posted was the message from the Ogden Police Department on Facebook. You know, that was the message that a lot of people saw first, about the event. So it seems like to me there's a little disconnect between whoever posted that message, understanding how the event happened and that it was kind of supposed to be that way, and then for everybody else kind of in administration to be like, oh, that wasn't exactly how it was planned. There seems like there's a little disconnect, because on the message it's really saying, this is what happened, we apologize, but we were working with them to have this exercise happen. At that moment, it didn't seem like the PD really thought there was any challenge, with the project.
And they
Maybe they don't have. Yeah, maybe
the
they don't
PIO,
have
The PIO with the police department's new and may not have understood. And,
right.
And the captain that made the call could have probably been empowered and felt empowered to say, hey, you guys said this was going to happen at 10. 12:30 is not okay, and we need to pull the plug on that. And those are some weaknesses that we've identified in this, that they need to feel empowered to do that. Anybody in a department director position, if you have a – and Chief Watt at that time was dealing with a bit of a family emergency.
Oh, yeah. No,
and
no.
Mm-hmm. They need to be able to go do that, take care of their family, and know that things are being covered back home. And that they people feel empowered to make those decisions and say, hey, this isn't going to work. I'm sorry. You guys can't delay it like this. You gave us promises you're not meeting, so we're going to pull the plug on it. And that didn't happen. And that, I think, will be remedied in the future. But as mentioned, we won't be conducting exercises like this in residential environments ever again. And, well, certainly not while I'm here. But there were some things that came out that we're going to be able to really improve on. So that could have been one of the calls that was made. Social media should have gone out. The door should have been knocked. And when it got that late, people should have been aware enough to say, you know, this isn't going to work. And you're going to have to do something different or reschedule or, although we want to be supportive, can't do this at that time.
Did you have anything more you wanted to roll out?
Well, I have a mistakes and lessons learned, if you guys want
me
to go through
that.
That's what
I kind of hope we could. I think at this point, you know, you can't rewrite the past, but we can look to the future to see what we can do better.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that's what we can spend the bulk of our time and make it productive. You know, you never want to have an event like this, but if you're going to have one, you might as well learn from it. You might as well put some good things in place. So.
So, Chair Heyer, before we move to lessons learned, which is where this all needs to go,
sure.
Are there any more questions? I had one. Someone asked me today to ask this question specifically, and I haven't asked it yet, but I do think I know the answer to it. But have we received any monetary payment for hosting the exercise?
Negative.
Okay.
There was no money exchanged hands. It was an effort to be supportive with our military and our law enforcement. So, yeah, they got the land use. We gave an agreement to go in and use it, but there was never any intent to make any money or receive any payment for it.
Is this kind of exercise in preparation for, I mean, I think you covered in the earlier, some of your earlier comments, but this question gets specifically to the questions that some people are asking. Was this exercise designed to address a similar kind of an exercise that could occur in Ogden in the future, or is it designed for an overseas preparation?
Not at all. The group that came in, and Randy's really good at dropping what every single Special Forces division does. It's a group that goes in, specially trained to go into urban environments, and like I mentioned earlier, this is the Benghazi group that went into Benghazi and tried to pull all of their diplomats out of the embassy there. So they have to go in the dark. The pilots don't know where they're going, and the scenarios are pretty carefully scripted so that these guys get urban training environment. So, yeah, there's no expectation, I think, from anybody here or anywhere else that would have a situation that would happen in our community that kind of a group would need to come in and do. It's just they're a real specially trained Special Forces group with the military that need to come into urban environments and conduct exercises sometimes. So, yeah, there's no applicable potential future for that group to ever come into Ogden City, Utah. I mean, we still are a really quiet and peaceful community. That group is, I think, 100% of their focus is on overseas and other places.
Can I ask a question about this, the IPAWS? How do you spell that?
IPAWS. Let me just make sure I have that right.
That's the way I spelled it, but I didn't know. So, had this really been an emergency, so in the future, if we did have some kind of a disaster, the dam broke, the earthquake happened, something happened, that would actually contact everybody in a radius?
So, it will hit every cell phone that a tower is associated with. So, Mark was telling a story the other day when he was in Zion Park hiking around. He got 30 because they were having all of these rainstorms and the potential for flash floods, which is an emergency. So every single cell phone in and around Springdale and other places, they would just push a big emergency notice out saying, hey, you are in danger, and you really need to be aware of this. But that doesn't come from us or any local agency. Right. You submit a request to the federal government. They review it and say, yeah, that is an emergency. So if the dam broke or you had, I'm sure, every fire in California, every one of those impacted communities got a bunch of those alerts. Like, here's what's going on in your community right now. This is a legitimate emergency, or an amber alert. I've had a number of those as I've driven through Idaho and other places. An amber alert would come up that had nothing to do with Ogden, Utah, but because I was in radius of that cell tower, they agreed that that's an emergency, and they would approve to send that out.
So do we feel comfortable about that technology? Is that something that, you know, last Tuesday we were kind of thinking, well, maybe we better rethink this whole notification process. Reverse 911, where does that fit into the whole thing, or is that what that is?
No, it's an opt-in program. Reverse 911 is an opt-in program. So if you want to receive notifications in the community for events like this in the future, you can go opt in, and if anything comes up, they will do a reverse 911 that will hit you. But you have to sign up your cell phone. One of the things that came out is I'm not home by my landline very rarely. I think it's forwarded to my wife's phone, but we carry our mobiles, and that's how we communicate anymore. And I think that's where most people communicate. So you can sign in, opt in for the reverse 911, and have your number as a notification number. And I know of a few people that did get notifications, and you know, okay, well, I'm not going to freak out about it too much. But it was very anemic. And we found that with the Uinta fire. For reverse 911 people, when the Uinta fire came online, and that was, you know, covering that community so fast, and at one point they thought there were thousands of structures because of the wind and everything else that were at risk for that, they would force people to sign up for the reverse 911. So they'd get their cell phones pinged, but then they could also say, hey, if you're going back into that area, we need you to sign up for this because we can't afford to call every single person and get in front of them, and we don't have the bandwidth to do that. But we can send out information on this reverse 911 program if you're in the affected area, and you'll get notification on exactly what's happening. It might have just been because they're not all emergency notices. You know, X neighborhood has opened up, and X neighborhood has opened up, and X neighborhood has opened up. And that's not something they can send through the iPod system. So we got a whole bunch of people that signed up for the reverse 911 program in the Uinta area as a result of the fire, because before they let them back in, they said, we really need to find a way to get in contact with you to keep you in up to date with what's going on. So that's it's a decent program, but we found that not a lot of people have signed up, and it didn't hit the scope and volume of what we had hoped it would. So that's a takeaway.
Is there a place we could get analytics around how many people are signed up? Or, I mean, just for our own information, not because of just this incident, but is there a way to find out how many residents we have signed up? Or?
Oh, yeah, and we can tell you exactly who it went out to, and Chief Matthew did a great job of kind of putting all of that data together, and we can be more than happy to send that data sheet to everybody in here. He was unfortunately out of town tonight.
Oh, I was just thinking for future reference, it might be nice to know how many residents total we have.
I'd be more than happy to get you those specifics.
I was going to say, I recall Chief Matthew said, it's a Weber County.
Right.
So out of the 88,000 numbers, phone numbers in Weber County, about 4,000 or 4,500 are signed up for the program.
Yeah, and I got a notice. That's why I'm
signed
up. I got a phone call and a text.
Mayor, I want to go back real quick to the issue with the contractor. So did you have a conversation, or someone had a conversation, a direct conversation with them after these happened to let them know that, you know, we're upset that, you know, and what was their response? I mean, was it a phone call? Was it an in-person conversation? How did that happen?
I bet three different phone calls were made to the contracting company.
Okay.
Chief Watt being one of them. saying, here's what you guys had promised, and we didn't receive any of that. We couldn't be more upset about it. You've really burned a lot of bridges in the community, and they didn't want us to do anything. They just said, just let it go. Nobody was hurt. Nobody was injured. We kind of did our part. We appreciate the community support, but just let it go. And we weren't willing to do that. So they're upset with us, but that's okay because, as I mentioned, when contractors come in and don't deliver, then we're okay with not having future contracts with some of those contractors.
Hmm. Okay.
Thank you. I get a sense that they do this a lot in a lot of places, and their objective is mission-focused. Let's get in and accomplish the mission, make sure nobody's hurt, and then let's get out. Their objective isn't like ours, that how do we take care of the community and make it, you know, a safe, inviting place to live and everything else. I don't believe that's on any of their radars.
So this is not a question, but I just want this to be on the record. If there's any opportunity for someone from our council to talk to this contractor also and let them know how we feel about it, I would look forward to that opportunity. Thank you.
I got to say, this idea that this contractor, they could have made this a good promotional thing had they done this right. This would have been a really interesting operation to have happen in your town if everybody was notified and if everybody understood it.
Absolutely.
And then it could have been an upside. But as it is, the way they did it was absolutely terrible. And, you know, I put a little Facebook Live out last week. I hope that other communities kind of learn from our mistakes. I think they need to have a serious change in direction of how they deal with communities, because this was terrible. This was just awful. And if anybody dropped the ball, as I listened to the department directors last Tuesday, boy, that's the only place that I could see that there was some real culpability. There was some real negligence. You know, they didn't care, and it was pretty obvious that they didn't care.
Well, it's the impact that the neighborhood experienced that evening that is troublesome to me. Is that, you know, if it happened in my neighborhood, I'd wonder what was going on.
Sure.
But it's, you know, I thank the mayor for realizing that this will not happen in a residential area in Ogden again. But you know, we talk about on the council being open to communications and being transparent, and we're still trying to learn to achieve those two objectives. And you know, we can learn from this is that, you know, we can make sure the communication is actually to the citizens of the area.
And I don't want all of this to come across as this was the fault of the contractor. There were some lapses with the contractor, but we internally had some lapses that we want to be fully responsible for and accountable for as well. So there were communication drops as we went from CED to OPD and to some other groups. This didn't rise to the level of an executive level because it did seem so benign on paper. And so we have a lot that we can do better and that we're committed to doing in the future. So, yeah, there were some issues there that promises were made that weren't kept, but it was on us to hold them accountable to the promises, and that did not happen. And so that is on us, and we can improve in a lot of regards with that.
Well, I think we can review that. Mayor, if you go to Lessons Learned, I think that's a big opportunity for us to evaluate where we're at and what we're going to do to move forward in that capacity.
Okay, do you want me to go on?
I have one question. Yes. First of all, I appreciate you answering Ben's question about did you receive any type of payment or anything, because that's the question that I've answered the most, or received the most. Number two, and maybe you could just explain this a little more. You said earlier that the call came in to CED, and I'm just curious, and the question I get asked is, how were we vying for this training opportunity, or were we selected out of a group of so many?
We were selected. We were not out pitching that, hey, come and have these exercises here. We were never involved in that. They called CED in originally for the Swift building. They'd seen pictures. They think, and it's probably correct that that's a building kind of condition you see in a lot of forward operating areas. To not say too much, but we recognized at the time that I don't think that building will work because we just are still working through some of the environmentals and making sure that that site gets cleaned up. And at the end of the day, you want the community to be safe, but you want those that come in and are drilling, our men and women in the military, to be safe as well. And we didn't feel like we could guarantee that we didn't, if you went into that building, we couldn't feel like there's enough unknown there that we felt like we just need at the end of the day for everybody to be safe. So that building wasn't going to work. They looked at the Flowers Foods site over here, but as I mentioned, that building was due to be demoed and that lot improved before this exercise took place. That happened. You can go see that work's been done quite a while ago. And then that was what they settled on next was, well, potentially we have these two vacant buildings up on that block, and we really think we could make that work. Would you be willing to talk to us about it? So that's kind of the flow of how that contact was made. But we never reached out and said, hey, come in and look at this, and we'll charge you $10,000. It was a completely voluntary, no money exchanged hands. We just wanted to be supportive of the military and our police department.
Well, was there a fourth option, or was that all we had to offer?
I'm not aware of a fourth option.
Okay.
I think that was Swift, yes, or Swift was no, and then the Flowers Foods building was a no because that was scheduled for demolition, and then what we had remaining was the IGA.
Okay.
Okay.
Anything else? I guess I have a question. We've talked about some of the technological failures, some of the other failure, but as far as communication within our department heads and staff, the human component, how have we assessed that, and how will we plug those holes?
When I came in, one of the things we recognized is that we weren't talking a lot as department heads, and so we have a number of meetings every single week. We have a department director meeting every single Tuesday where we all come together. Every department director gets to talk about what's going on in their departments, what their issues, challenges are, and we collectively get to give advice and input into what happens there. And we kind of have a similar one on Thursdays, which is we call it the river meeting because the river project a number of years ago was at such loggerheads. When I first came into that meeting, we had, I think, a half dozen attorneys in the room and 20 people sitting around the table because they could not figure out how to get anything going down there. So we kept that meeting. So every Thursday we have a meeting where any economic development projects that are coming along, engineering projects, everything else, we come in and put all of that on the table, and you get the input and advice from everybody in there. So we've done a lot to get in front of everybody and give them an opportunity to participate. We do it during the entire budget system as well. Every time we prepare a budget, we do a three-day retreat where everybody comes into the room and we examine every single penny and dollar spent. And it's exhausting. One of the things I tell my wife when I get home is we have tons of issues and ounces of resources. And you prioritize every single dollar and penny that's spent on that, and that's encouraged. And so we do have a lot of different forums where people can come together and talk and ask questions and really share what's happening in their departments. And this came up, it was mentioned a time or two, but again, the initial contract and expectations that were sent just didn't rise to a level that really took a deep dive from everybody. And in retrospect, we absolutely would have done that.
Mayor? So, have you thought about our demographics in that area? Probably have 50% Hispanic population in the East Central, and how are we communicating with them? In your letter, it was on social media. I know it was on Facebook, right? But Is there something else that we need to do or that we can do? I mean, I know it's after the fact, and I don't mean to sound bad. I don't care how the contractor feels, obviously, right? But there's probably people out there that still don't know what happened, right? So to me, still some sort of another effort to try to let the people know. I'm thinking about the Spanish-speaking community, our Hispanic community. The people that are reading, you know, not everybody's reading Facebook, not everybody is using electronic means. And so I don't know if you thought about that, but if you haven't, if you would please be willing to consider that.
We'll certainly put some thought into that, and that's part of the reason we have Viviana in our office, is to help kind of, you know, work through some of that and figure out different ways. I get that not everybody's on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, and so that is a challenge to connect.
And again, you know, just thinking about what I heard when these happened from a lot of people, you know, just a lot of scared people, mm-hmm. right? And there are different dynamics even in the Hispanic community. This could be fighting forever for anybody. And then within the Hispanic community, some additional dynamics why this could be particularly scary.
Sure.
And so I think if they don't hear a message from us, from the city, we're probably doing a disservice to them. So I think that will be very, very important to look into.
That's great.
Please. Okay. Thank you.
Luis, if I could address you with regard to that, because you're kind of our resident expert.
Yes, sir.
Other languages. I read a lot of posts that were posted about this, and there were some really good ideas. I mean, quite frankly, there were some people came up with some ideas for us that would be very helpful. I don't read Spanish, so did you happen to come up with any from that Spanish-speaking community?
Ideas?
Let's get them on the table, and let's make sure we utilize those things.
There weren't any ideas in Spanish. There were just a few complaints. There were just a few of some of those common messages of people were upset and angry. I read one message was in Spanish. When I put out a statement on Facebook, I got a few messages. One of them, a woman just said that, you know, she was in a lot of distress, thinking that something was happening, and it was in Spanish. And I wrote him back, and then I wrote to some other people, and so there weren't ideas, but I have ideas, and we can talk about it.
Maybe that's a conversation we need to have at a later date. Thank you.
Thank you.
But it does speak to a need, and I mean, lessons learned obviously is the mode we're in. I think you and I have talked about it a lot, Luis, that there is a need to reach out there, and it has to be done in a different way than what we're used to doing. When we get ideas, it also is important that we make that a priority, right? And so I think we as a council can commit, and at least I'm personally committing as vice chair, and it sounds like Chair Hire is committing too. I can't imagine anybody on this council not committing to that. That's something we want to do better at, and that we've got to do better. This highlights the fact that we don't have it. But it also highlights the need for it. In talking to you, it sounds like we might hear a handful of concerns and complaints, but it's probably not representative of the scale of the complaints, because we're talking about people that don't reach out to us, that are afraid to and avoid us as a whole because of trust and other dynamics at play. And so therein lies the exact benefit of diversity here, right? Diversity amongst us is that is an opportunity for us to do better on something that we don't know what to do. And so I'm really looking forward to hearing some of your recommendations and giving it the priority it deserves.
Thank you.
Coming back from a country that I could not even say hello to, if there had been something there that would have happened, I don't know how I would have. I mean,
that occurred to me too.
That wouldn't have mattered to me.
I'm not sure if that's something that you set as a preference when you sign up, or how it all works. I don't know.
I bet knowing how these advanced these technologies are, I bet there's a very easy way to, either if someone selects Spanish to be their language, they'll get a message in Spanish, or you can have two messages to go out, one in English, one in Spanish. I could see that happening very easy.
We can find that out. And we do, 911 does contract with language assistance programs, but I think they have 35 different languages that they can translate to. So if a 911 call comes into 911 and it's a Korean or Vietnamese, they have language services that are there to help translate and work through that. The vast majority is obviously Spanish in this community, but they typically will have about 35 different translation requests during the course of an operational year. But that's a good question. We can find
out. I just want to kind of piggyback on that. I really appreciate that everybody's talking about alternate forms of outreach, because it makes me think that sometimes maybe we don't see, social media or these other forms of communication as valid, as the formal channels for communication. I'm not talking about you, I'm just saying we as a society. And I really think that I want to frame, some of those very personal stories that were posted on Facebook, about people having negative experiences or going through some trauma, to think about other ways of reaching out to those folks, because I don't expect them to additionally then send us a formal letter or show up at a public meeting or et cetera. So I think that I really do want to take examples of, one or two of those stories and say that's actually a bigger population that wasn't ready to post it out to social media to everybody in the world, or also just to understand that people probably, experienced it in a much different way than maybe we would have thought, or, just to kind of open our eyes to all those different perspectives or experiences. So I really appreciate you thinking about alternate forms of communication. It makes me think, and many constituents have asked me too, what is the Ogden City website for? What are these other platforms for that are formal too, that we're not really taking advantage of as far as communicating with folks about things that are happening, right? And where do they get information? So when the event was happening, people called 911, and then they called this, the non-emergency number. But even in those phone calls I've heard, and I can't validate this, but there wasn't much information to give back to people. They said, it's a drill. And then if they asked further questions, is it real bullets? Or, what are the details? They actually weren't able to share many details, too. So I think those are all things to think about that are challenges. There's formal communication lines. There's more informal, and then what are some other alternatives that we could use to make sure
we've talked about that since this time, and Marsha actually brought it up one time when she was out of town, and there was the huge windstorm, and she had people texting her, asking her for questions to be answered, and there was no clearinghouse for information, and so we talked about that with the mayor a little bit the other day. Of course, it's still in its infancy, but certainly that thing needs to be developed to where there is a place that people can go and say, okay, this is what's happening. And
even us. When we're getting messages first thing in the morning, we don't know who to call. Who do I call?
if the rest of you are like me, I woke up early that morning. I was before the kids. I made my cup of coffee. I thought I had some time, and I immediately opened, as soon as I got to instant message or social media, was alarmed at the commotion. And clearly, a lot of the lessons learned are revolving around communication. The internal communication amongst the administration, communication before the event with the community, communication between the contractor, communication between the administration and the council, and et cetera. We've been talking a lot about communication and community engagement here in this council, and we've taken really aggressive steps as to how we can do better. I think it still continues to be a priority here. And this event has really highlighted why that's a priority. And I can't say that I fully recognize this need in terms of advanced community engagement, but when we talk about all of the different ways that we ought to be communicating with people, clearly social media is a part of it. But I think that we benefited the most as a council when we heard from people directly, and that we had relationships with people who knew how to contact us, and that we were reachable and available, and that we had the ability to then reach back to their site and say, I mean, I think I called you and you were in the same situation I was when I called you.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, good morning, Mayor. Are you seeing what's going on? And it's like, it was early.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, what do you mean? What's going on? And, right?
Yeah.
And
so, give me a chance to look into that.
Yeah, there's this whole need for interaction and communication and relationships with each other that has just got to be there. And I can tell from the council side, I sat up one night with Janie, my wife, talking late into the implications of what we've experienced. Like, it really panicked me when I thought about the potential of a real emergency as to what we learned here. And this communication issue, it's only not just a matter of identifying challenges and fixing it. I think we're going to have to commit some resources to communication.
I think so. I think there's some reconciliation.
We really have to commit resources.
Yeah, and I think there is some reconciliation that needs to be made for those folks that were impacted by this event.
So. Uh-huh.
And I think that includes, you know, doing some door-to-door, like hanging out in the park, like going to the places where the people are versus expecting them to come to us because mm-hmm. we've done something wrong. Or, you know, we haven't personally, but something wrong has happened to them.
Right.
Right? And so we need to do something to reconcile that.
And that's where that personal
right.
interaction is so important, right? So they know who we are, we know who they are, we know what they're really experiencing. So.
There's a lot of...
objectives of our council is to be more responsive to the citizens.
Right. We could have a lot of discussion about this. It could go on for hours. But we have the mayor in front of us, and I want to make sure that he has all the time that he needs to disseminate what he wanted to. Did you have anything else you wanted to make sure that got out? And
we've hit most of the mistakes, lessened and learned. I can go through it again just to kind of confirm where we're going to be focused in the next little bit. Obviously, we had some issues with the contractor. Our duty is to go in and make sure that they fulfill the promises that they make to us, and some of that did not happen. Our interdepartmental coordination broke down with the handoff from CED to PD. Communication with city administration was inadequate, and you guys obviously were not notified. Had we known the scope and scale, you would have all known about it. As it was given to us, it was.
Are we normally notified when there's a training exercise?
I know. And that's what we've talked about before. Yeah. Is that if there's going to be a disruptive one, we certainly want to notify. SWAT team does one or two a month, and I think everybody would get just overwhelmed with some of what's going on. So that's something for you guys. We can communicate back and forth on. Had we known it was going to be that, we certainly would have been in front of everybody and asked, you know, permission and had some dialogue about it. We just didn't know at that point. So any training exercise we see that might be disruptive in the future, we would absolutely bring for consideration and to get your feedback on. We lacked a communication plan with clear roles and responsibilities. We have PIOs and all these different agencies. We didn't have one lead PIO to manage this. Not knowing the scale, I don't know what we would have done different, but we are working on that. I think that's critical, and that goes back to Ben's comments about communication. Proper notification of residents. In our meetings on Tuesday, they talked a lot about, had we known, we would have gone and hit every door in that entire neighborhood and left a door hanger on every door handle. So more people out on the streets knocking on doors, and the reliance on a reverse 911 that did not work and was really anemic was very well clarified. And as I said, that's part of the reason you get involved in some of these drills is so you can get a lot better and realize where your gaps are. The information was not broadly disseminated on websites and social media. We can do a lot better with that. And then, as mentioned, we had a big exercise at the airport a week before that the Chief Matthew talked about, but they put variable message boards out. You had 10 fire trucks there and a whole bunch of ambulances and everything else, but you didn't get a single phone call or anything else because everybody just were able to drive by and say, oh, well, there's an exercise, and it says that on the message board. This was a little different. Special Forces didn't want those kinds of messages out there because it's supposed to be a little bit more covert, and so there was some miscommunication on what we could do and what their expectations were, and so we can certainly improve that. Next steps, those are lessons learned that we're working on solutions for. There'll be no more military training exercises. And we will work with council leadership and staff to improve coordination on interdepartmental projects, including the involvement of our administration and you all, and anything that we see that might come up and have question marks or disruptions. I mean, I think some of the people that talked about coming from other countries and being a regular part of their day-to-day, wondering what the heck's going on. I mean, those are sensitivities that sometimes we need to hear from everybody. We're committed to being willing to listen to that and to work around some of that. And then we'll continue to review and improve our communications for crisis situations and drills. As mentioned, there is a good communication strategy for mobile for a crisis with that iPod system. For a drill or other community notifications, code red and reverse 911 didn't work at all, and we don't have access to that iPod communication system. That's for emergencies only. So we can do a lot to improve our communications strategies and how we connect with the community in the future, and we're committed to doing that.
Anything else?
Just a couple things. As I've just reflected on the experience we've all had, I think about communication. You and I have had this conversation a number of times. I think it's important that we not minimize communication after the event. We've talked a lot about communication before with notification and during the exercise and so on. I get really nervous about our communication after the event to make sure that people know what resources are out there, what information is out there, but also so that people feel that that they know where to turn to get feedback and guidance, and that they know their local leaders are leading and addressing whatever it is that happened in our community. So I really want to make sure that, and we can make sure of it on our side with the council, that we need to commit our resources to some of these emergency communications plans. We have staff in place with Brandon, and we have a lot of communications expertise on our staff because of that priority. I'd like to make sure that we follow up to make sure that we have emergency communication planning in place, not only pre and during, but post. And this is something that we as a council have already made clear that we're going to address. And I just hope that you guys would make that same priority and commitment so that we can reach back and make sure that we're both clear on what our roles are. I mean, you guys have a significant role day of, and we actually have a really carefully defined role day of as well. And we all need to be aware of what our role is and isn't. And that's what we intend to clarify for on our end. But if we don't both commit to it, we're not going to solve it.
You have that complete commitment on our end.
Okay. Appreciate that.
I support what Ben has said, but the thing that I question is why wasn't the call made to the mayor's office way back in July that we'd like to come in your city and do this type of an operation? Because I would assume that he would be the one that would evaluate it and look with his directors and say, let me get back with you on this operations, whether it's a feasible one. But I agree, communications is very important to us, and there was an impact to the citizens in that neighborhood, and I feel very sorry for that, and I apologize for that.
And we do too. And to directly answer that question, had this looked like something that was going to have that kind of impact,
Yeah. That
absolutely would have come. But it went through four different departments, and everybody kind of thought, we do these trainings all the time, and it's going to be inside and very minimal impact to the community, happened just after dusk. That was a whole different thing on paper when we initially got it than it turned out to be. So I do think that when they do see something for what it is and its impact, that they're quick to bring that to the administration or to the department director meeting and to say, hey, there's some things that are evolving that we think we need some help with. This just was an event that it kind of caught everybody, flew under everybody's radar, and then it ended up being a lot bigger than was initially sold or intended by any of us.
One of the things that we forget, because we hear it and you do training a lot, is what you do all the time, is that anytime training, anytime that something's out of the ordinary, there's many citizens that get upset. So even our SWAT trainings, I think we get calls and we get text messages, and so I think that the way to communicate that would be
okay.
I don't know how that looks or what that looks like.
Let us work on that. I think that's something that I'm hearing a lot too, is that there's got to be a way that we can, you know, receive kind of, I don't know, a little bit of what you get, and then we can decide how to disseminate it. The mayor has offered on numerous occasions when I brought it up, he says, I'll tell you whatever you want, but you don't want it all. Trust me. And I think he's right. So we've got to figure out a system or a method or some kind of a criteria by which we can rank these kind of things so that we do know what's important to us.
And some of them aren't trainings. SWAT gets called out, you know, a lot, and I'll get a text message like, holy cow, I just drove by X, Y, and Z address, and you got a whole bunch of people out there, and I don't think that they want me knowing about it. I don't think, I mean, they need to go in and execute it and not have a big audience that's there. So it's always kind of a fine balance. I mean, I'll tell you my first day on the job when they went, when that, you know, enormous tragedy happened with Jared Frankum, I didn't know that was going on, and I don't know that I want to know that every time the SWAT team gets called out, they go through their risk matrix, and if the SWAT team goes in, then that's something that they are in law enforcement in charge of. I don't know how to read that. I don't know how to validate that. I think if it gets political when they go through their matrix and have to send out, you know, a public notification before they go in when they've got warrants and everything is legal and a judge is fun. It's a delicate balance sometimes. So.
And we live in a sensitive time also.
Absolutely, we do.
I have one other question for you. Just concerning the SWAT training, do those ever take place in a residential area? I mean, we haven't had a problem and no one's ever raised a concern like that, but do we do those in residential areas?
I've heard that they do, and sometimes in an abandoned house, you need to go in and get into a house and figure out how to work as a team to get through it. But I would imagine that the process would be no different, that all the neighbors would get notice that, hey, nothing's going on. We're having a training in this abandoned house, so don't be alarmed or anything else. But then that would be my expectation with any training that happened in some of those areas. Occasionally they do need to go into abandoned homes and buildings and work as a team to go through those. That's part of the loss, unfortunately, of the Swanson Tactical Center. They could go do a lot of that out in the industrial area where they weren't bothering anybody, and now that they don't have access to that, it makes it a little tougher to go in and train in realistic environments. And so, yeah, I would imagine that some of that does happen, but again, that's not something that typically gets to.
They seldom ever fly in on a Chinook helicopter either.
Yeah.
Does anybody know how many helicopters were there? I've heard rumors of different numbers.
I heard three. Is that
three? Is what
three?
I heard.
Yeah. Chinook and Apache. Is that one here?
Chinook and two Blackhawks.
And two, or, oh, yeah. Okay.
Chair Heyer, I'm sure you. I'm sure this has been clear, but just also echoing what Ben said and what Doug said about these communication issues and concerns and flaws that we see that go beyond letting you know what's happening and what to tell you and what not to tell you. But we're talking about a larger institutional and systemic problem and challenge that we have with communication and community engagement. And so, again, I also request respectfully that we seize these moments and we just take a really hard look into, and we lay out steps on how we're going to come up with a plan to finally address these and not let it continue to go on any longer. And I really sincerely appreciate the mayor saying, I'm on board. We all want this, so let's just seize the moment and take advantage, and let's make it happen.
You have my commitment as well.
Yeah, thank you.
And that was my commitment to you as well. When I said we're going to have to invest in that, we have to commit resources to it.
Let's just get it done.
Absolutely, it's got to be done.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Anything else?
I guess I'm curious, and following up, I've had lots of people ask, and I'm curious too, were there any negative interactions that the police or any of the people involved in the incident had with any residents? Because I know there was people calling 911 on the non-emergency number, but were there any interactions that were negative or arrests or anything like that?
Not for 911. They did say they had a couple of people they thought may have been intoxicated at 7-Eleven that tried to go wander or onto the seen that they had to kind of redirect, but they said that no, people were, for the most part, really respectful and stayed out of the way. And like I said, nobody got hurt or injured or anything else, but there was some curiosity that they, and the officers did interact with people that came out and wanted to know what was going on, but I haven't heard of any reports of any negative interactions.
That answer your question?
Yeah. And do we have any idea what the numbers were? I was asking leadership earlier about, like, how many people called 911 or...
I believe the number was just over 100 that called. Typical during that time period, they'll get 10 to 15. So a lot of citizens did reach out and say, hey, what the heck's going on?
And that seemed to be how most people got the information. A good number of folks called dispatch, got the answer, and then disseminated amongst themselves on social media. I think that's how people ultimately broadly understood it to be training. But you know, as it relates to no one was injured, and thank goodness they weren't, I was just asked, I think it was Marcia, asked about it earlier today about what can we do for folks that have PTSD. I made you aware of it for the first time, but we had asked when we were hearing all the concern about those folks that are struggling with that condition, what could we do? And we asked our staff to assemble a list of community partners and resources and to reach out to those groups and find out what can be done. We have a pretty good list that they've put together for us. If anybody else is being contacted, we can make that available to you to share with them, because that may not be a physical injury, but that is an injury of its own.
An injury.
It's that there is still pain and people are still hurt out there.
Perhaps maybe we should post that so we can share it too, because we don't want, like I said before, we don't want to expect people to contact us, you know, necessarily. We want to maybe go above and beyond and just reach out to them in some way.
Okay. Is there anything else?
One last quick question. In your debriefings that you had with your department heads, Mayor, was the message that came out from OPD on Facebook, was that addressed? I believe that message, a lot of people found it insensitive and a little insensitive.
Yes, it was.
Was that addressed?
Yes, absolutely it was.
Okay.
It was addressed in that, and it was addressed in the leadership meeting we had with all the people that were involved in that.
Okay,
as well.
So that's part of your lessons learned?
Correct. That's
okay.
Absolutely correct.
All right. Thank you.
And I'll just speak to that because, you know, the officer that did it was in our meeting on Tuesday, and it was clear just how hurt the officer was for the hurt the officer created. The emotion was very real. And my response to that was not that individual deserves help and training. That's what that person's need. And I didn't want to scold him. I want to help him because he's a person of incredible character, and he's reflective of the kind of people that we want here. But he clearly recognizes a mistake and would clearly benefit from training. And so let's make sure that we give our people, right, what they need to be successful, and I think that's exactly what is needed there. And anyone else who is a PIO, and I would ask the same question to our PIO, do you have what you need to be successful? Because that was a clear need. Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor. Appreciate you being here.
Okay, we'll see you in a few minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Next item on our agenda is the Waste Transfer Station Zone Text Amendment.
Amy. Yeah, I'll very briefly introduce this. So this item we discussed during your October 30th work session meeting. That was prior to the Planning Commission's discussion and recommendation. So this evening we asked Greg to return, received a transmittal last week from Greg, a very, very fast turnaround. Thank you, Greg, on that. And with that, he has the Planning Commission's recommendation on this item for you this evening.
Okay. So we have talked about this, but I wanted to share with you what we shared with the Planning Commission and their recommendation to you. So as Amy said, we had the Planning Commission act on this on November 7th. It was basically this item called a pending ordinance. This pending ordinance was posted in June of this year. And what it said is the city is considering removing waste transfer stations from the M2 zone as a conditional use. The under state law, pending ordinances have a six-month time frame where things are suspended for the city to consider what actions they may take on that ordinance, collect any information they desire, and then come up with that. The reason the pending ordinance was created was basically because the conflicts were taking place and complaints from neighbors of an operation that was being handled as a waste transfer station. Since that time, of course, that's been resolved, but that was the reason the pending ordinance was created, to make sure that people understood that, no, we don't have any approved transfer stations in Ogden City at this point. How did we get to develop a transfer station? I think that becomes the first question. With the closure of the county landfill, one of the things that became clear was that landfills were no longer going to be an acceptable means of disposing of waste in Weber County. For many, many decades, the Weber County landfill was operated in West Ogden, and to the detriment of that neighborhood, all the waste was taken to that landfill and deposited. But that's not the first time we've had waste in Ogden City. We've had the area where Big D Sports Park was a landfill at one point. 31st Street Interchange was a landfill at one point. Even recently, we had a C&D landfill just to the west of the 21st Street Pond. And so we've had those operations, some types of those operations take place of disposing of waste within the city limits. But when the county made the determination there would be no more landfills, and that Ogden was probably the chief site for the transfer station, it was important for us to develop an ordinance of how to handle that location within Ogden city limits. And so the transfer station was considered, an ordinance was developed and adopted in 2017. At that point, as we prepared for that, the final determination was the county located the transfer just outside the city limits. So that transfer station ordinance that we developed was not utilized with the location of the Weber County transfer site. It was located, as I mentioned, just west of the city limits. We've talked about this before, what a transfer station is, and that is where individuals or contracted haulers take waste to a centralized facility, and then that waste is gathered and then taken to landfills, transport to some other location. Right now, the county takes their waste to a facility out in Tooele. There's also a multi-jurisdictional facility that's operated out of southern Utah County, a large facility that many communities have contracted with to have their waste taken to those areas. But that's what a transfer station does. It collects the garbage, the refuse, and then sends it to a landfill that's in some other location, hence the name waste transfer station. That's all it does, is all the waste is brought there, collected, shipped.
Greg, do you have this is not related to that, but how many of those containers does Ogden fill up every week?
I don't know, Jay, would you have an idea of what our refuse is?
A lot of them.
How many?
I can get you.
Yeah.
It's not one, though.
It's not one.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I have no clue what the size is. Yeah.
Now, this doesn't have anything to do with that. I was just churning in my mind. I just have never known.
Well, you figure, I mean, we're about 34% of the county population. Mm. But sometimes with the urban setting, we may dispose of more refuse than the others.
Maybe.
So I'm not sure what the number would be if you broke them down. So when the Planning Commission took a look at this pending regulation, given the history of how we got to where we're at, the main things we focused in on was the general plan. What is it directing us to do? What are the considerations that we have? Two items in the general plan talk about items of diversifying our city's economic base in many, many different ways. And the other one talks about preventing environmentally inappropriate development. Now, those statements in and of themselves can be interpreted many different ways. And in the general plan, that is one of the ideas, is those are general statements, and they can have some different meanings. So then it's up to the officials, the elected officials, which would be you, to determine, okay, what is the appropriate action? Because this is a policy decision of land use. It's not a cut-and-dry thing. So as the Planning Commission, we talked about the fact that we'll be growing. The county will be growing. And with that growth, we grow in waste, too. The fact that there'll be additional demands with limited abilities are something to consider. I know as we talked with the one part of the Weber County discussion, they felt that they've got a very good handle on it and can handle additional waste for the future and looking at different things. One of the things we looked at is if transfer stations wanted to locate in Weber County today, where could they locate? Well, as we looked at other city ordinances and even county's ordinance, there's only two possibilities. One is Ogden City allows a waste transfer station in the M2 zones as a conditional use. Or two, Weber County allows them in an unincorporated county if it's owned and operated by the county. Those are the only two options that exist in terms of zoning ordinances in the communities within the city, within Weber County itself. So with that limited opportunity, that was some of the discussion the commission had. That led to the idea of competition versus quality of life. Is there a benefit for a free market type situation with waste disposal, waste transfer? Is it a government operation? How should that be handled? And also at the same time, the ability of quality of life, because transfer stations do have impacts. When we developed the transfer station ordinance in 20-some-odd years ago, there were a lot of vacant areas. Those vacant areas have decreased. We have a lot of areas that are now infill with neighbors next to it. Those are different situations now than something coming in new, being surrounded by vacant land, versus something being interjected into an area that's developed on all the sides. Those are some considerations and discussions that the commission had about those type of impacts. One of the things we discussed was the fact that our ordinance was based on 96 technology. One of the concerns we have, are there things out there now that may make transfer stations more compatible when there's neighbors next to them, other than the regulations we have already? That was some discussion among the commission. Some talked about operations that seem to work in other cities and even in other countries, and how they work and operate. And do we have that same technology? Do we have those same things in place in our ordinance? We don't. We were looking at some things that took place in the 90s as far as how we manage waste transfer. And so we discussed that under the present ordinance, is that sufficient to protect adjacent property owners and to protect the economic development we want to have happen in the community? So as the Planning Commission discussed that and made their recommendation, they voted 5-2 to make a recommendation to you to eliminate waste transfer stations as a conditional use in the M2 zone. One of the things they didn't do, and this was purposely, was not to eliminate the standards of a waste transfer station, but eliminate it as a use. They wanted us to explore opportunities and what technologies may be out there, that if there becomes what they see as a demand in the future, that as we grow and increase and maybe there's additional market demands, that we have the basis in place that we can do research in the meantime to try to modify those regulations and at a time and place appropriate, that may be a reconsideration. So that's why the requirements were not taken out of the ordinance. They were the basic building blocks for whatever may happen in the future. And so their recommendation is only to take out as an existing land use of conditional. One of the things that was discussed a little bit, and I think the Planning Commission was trying to get a better handle on it, is conditional uses. The fact that, again, when the ordinance was created, the Planning Commission could say yes or no to specific locations. We were looking especially at the county at that point and saying, okay, county will work with us, we'll select sites. Some of you may be aware that at the time, the county's primary site they first want to look at was the 2021st Street split just west of Wall. That would be the transfer station location. Then some other locations were thrown out. and finally, as I said, they moved and put it outside of Ogden City. But since that time, conditional uses have changed. I mean, conditional uses are now under state law where you set the standards for mitigation, but if those standards can be met, you can't deny the location. So any of the M2 areas would be allowed for a transfer station. And I know in your packet, Glenn put together a map of the M2 zones and that dark purple area on those that map you have, I think, on page 5 of that section. I don't know how it's numbered in your...
Yes, no, that's
okay.
Correct.
Okay.
You're on target.
First time.
no.
So that kind of gives you an idea of where the present ordinance would allow waste transfer stations as it exists now. And again, you couldn't say, the Planning Commission couldn't say no to that location. All they could set is the standards they have to meet. And I think that was one of the things that, as the Commission discussed too, of how the conditional uses have evolved, and knowing what the pending ordinance is a reason, again, they said, no, let's take it out at this present time, recommend it be removed, and so we can consider in the future if there are appropriate locations and what those standards would be, knowing it'd be standard-based now and not location-based. So that's the Planning Commission's recommendation to you.
So the two negative votes, the two dissenting votes, who and why?
So Kathy Blaisdell and Angel Costello voted no. They felt that the conditional use process would be adequate enough to give protection, and that we could also add additional conditions, even though they may not be written, of what could mitigate impacts.
Can you spend just a minute and talk about this conditional use process again, just so that we can be clear what can and can't be done with conditional uses?
Okay. So in the zoning ordinance, you have three things that can happen with the use. Not allowed, conditional use, or permitted. Well, not allowed is straightforward. You can't do it there. Permitted is straightforward. It's a staff review, and you just meet the letter of the ordinance, and you're allowed. Conditional use is a hearing before the Planning Commission to determine what are the potential impacts and what are the mitigating things that can reduce those potential impacts to neighbors. And so at that time, we notify those neighbors and ask them to come and give their voice and concern about the use, what they see would be an impact. And then the commission determined what measures should be established in the requirement for that individual project for it to go forward. So if it's noise, it's limiting. It may be limiting the hours of operation. It may be saying things have to be indoors. If it's dust and that, it may be saying, okay, you got to have control factors. Either you have to water the area, or maybe, again, it has to be inside. If there are things that are visually unattractive to other businesses, you have to screen them, you have to hide them, you have to do something so that the neighbor doesn't perceive them. Those become things that they can establish as conditions. Does that kind of answer you?
It does. I'm going to ask you for your opinion.
Okay.
To me, what the state has done to conditional uses makes this type of a use impractical to use with a conditional use.
I'd agree.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think the trend is two things. One, and I think the state really wants us to go that way. One is to set a use with conditions. Set up all your conditions to begin with, mm-hmm. of what you feel are impacts. Have them clearly written so that the person knows what to expect, and not come to a meeting and then have it discussed and then go back and forth and something added here, something deleted here. Mm-hmm. Just say, this is the standard. If you want to meet it, you're welcome. If you don't want to meet it, well, you find another location.
So that makes it a permitted use instead
of
conditional use.
Right.
Okay. All right.
So, and I think that's the way the state really wants to see things happen.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Greg about that? Okay.
So I just have one thing to note. After our meeting on October 30th and our discussion, there was interest in doing some additional outreach on this item, so we did reach out to all of the recycling centers in the M2 zone, as well as some of the neighboring properties to Recycled Earth who were interested and involved in the public hearing at the Planning Commission meeting. Oh, my goodness. And so we did have some additional mailings that occurred on this item, and if there's level of comfort, this is set for consideration and has been noticed for consideration next week. So any questions or concerns with that?
Does that, and that meets the deadline of the 6 months, right?
Yes. So December 2nd is when the
December 2nd is
notice of pending ordinance expires.
Okay. All right. Any questions about that?
Have we gotten any feedback or anything from that?
We haven't in our office. There was a request from Mr. David Rawson from Recycled Earth to make comment during the work session tonight, but we've invited him to come to the public comment portion during next week's meeting on this item, just to kind of give fair opportunity to everyone. Planning did, and I think I mentioned this before, they invited Mr. Rawson and others with interest to come and make presentations to the Planning Commission to provide some context on this issue as well. So we haven't received anything directly in our office. There were four commenters during the Planning Commission's public hearing, three in support of the proposal and one not in support.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right.
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it. Next item on our agenda is the Monarch and Moda Migrating Mural.
So I'll provide a really quick introduction on this. So this item before you actually has a couple of different actions and pieces associated with it. So the first item that's being proposed is a budget transfer of $20,000 from the Public Arts Support Fund and the Capital Improvement Plan Fund to go into the general fund, and then for the funding from general fund to be awarded as an art grant in support of the Monarch and Moda mural project that was completed in the Nine Rails Creative District recently. And this is a little bit unique because this is an arts grant, and we just barely completed the arts grant process, and so it's a little bit out of regular process for us to look at this option. But the ordinance does permit this. So with that, Lori's here to make a presentation.
Thank you for having me here today, and let's talk about a little bit lighter subject like butterflies. Phew, this has been a heavy meeting. I just don't know if you looked at your packet, which had a little study that I wrote about the potential impact that this project will have on our community. There's already been several national write-up about Ogden having this project in it. There's the Chicago Tribune, USA News. It was on Google News feed for quite a while because I have several people that know me from out the country that said, is this something you did? So it's been really great to see how much that we've already received just in with how new it's been. There is a publication coming out that will be released that will because she's doing such a large installation across the country with this, so we'll be in a book, and this will be a destination. So Ogden will become a destination for people that will actually seek out to come see all of her installations of this. So I don't know, more than anything, I was kind of here not to do a presentation, but more answer your questions about the project. So is there, let me do... Should we do that, or do you want me to just go through my study, or?
I don't know. If I've got up to see the project. It's really beautiful and inviting, and it's really just generally cool. Any of you have questions about the project at all that way, or do we have Lori go into that, or should we go into some of the questions?
One of the questions was to please discuss this project and its and describe the anticipated time period of this art project to be displayed. So is it going to go away sometime or not?
There's no plan to remove the project. Murals are, in essence, ephemeral because they don't last forever. But it isn't the intention for that project to go away at any time. It will be up as long as it feasibly can until it, doesn't look good anymore, I imagine, or maybe they'll have her come back and touch it up, but there is no plans to remove it.
Is there an average lifespan for murals at all, or is that kind of difficult to assess?
It's difficult to assess because it depends on how well the paint was applied and if they sealed it, and they took a lot of precautions on this one. It's done like top-notch, really well done. But other ones, you know, where it's just maybe a local artist painting a mural, those tend to not last as long, but it can be several years that they'll stand up to in the environment.
The project's unbelievable. I mean, it is just spectacular. I commend you on it. I mean, I'm certainly proud of it when we drive by it.
It's a perfect anchor piece for the new creative district. It really
is. And I love to hear all of the exposure in the media that you mentioned. That's great. Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised because I've seen it. But I think the question that Doug read was, I think, kind of getting also at the, you know, we're asked to approve funding for a project that's already done.
So this is definitely not the normal and probably not something that you would see. I don't know if it's ever happened. Definitely not since I've been at the city. The project came through in the very early stages of the project. We were asked to participate, but we don't have a mechanism in place to be part of the. So it was Weber State, Nature Center, O1 Arts, a lot of community members coming together to try to get this project in place.
Stop. Can I hear, not yes. Stop, but can I ask a question real fast? When you say for we to participate, who's we?
Well, the city, yeah, the city, as city being part of this community-wide project that was in place. Our public art ordinance does not allow us to install art on land or buildings that we don't own, and it can't be a sole source, like, so because Jane Kim had to be the artist on it because it is part of her nationwide project, we weren't able to participate like I wanted to be a part of it, but there was no mechanism for me to, like, be a part of it from the very beginning. I talked to legal about it, and we talked about, can I do a sole source for this to do it? And the amount of money was not something that legal was comfortable with doing a sole source for. So it ended up, I really just thought we wouldn't be involved, you know, and then it ended up happening anyways, and then we received a formal request for funding as part of a community project from O1 Arts in, I think, August. And that's why we're here at this point, because there wasn't a way for me to be involved because of the ordinances that we have to follow from the way the public art funds are used.
So would our approval require a waiver of the, or an exception to an ordinance, beyond just the approval of the funds?
I think that's why we're doing this as a one-time off 1082 study, to show that we are wanting to do this as a special circumstance because of the impact it will have on the community and the amount of support that we think it's going to be for the new creative district. I think this is why it's, you know, why we're pushing for this to happen, because it is so impactful and good for our community in tourism and following both our arts master plan and the creative district master plan. So it really was like a perfect thing to happen with what we've been working so hard to get into place.
Tom's cocked and ready to go. Do you want to come up, Tom? And
yes.
I have some questions. We've talked about this a lot in leadership, about some of the potential implications. And
so normally there's two channels that we fund art projects through: the general fund, which is the typical project that we do that is submitted and reviewed and there are criteria. And then there are the projects that we do for, used to be called percentage for arts. It's mm-hmm. just the flat rate. This one obviously didn't fit either one. So we approached it as an impact to the community and an economic benefit. And there was an economic benefit study done, which was part of your packet. It's based on that the 1082 decision is made as to contribute to the project because of its beneficial social and economic impact to the community, which that is part of what's there. So that's how we got to this particular situation.
I have one question that goes along with that. Do we have any projects that are in line to come on board? And if so, how is that process taken care of? Do you present it to the Arts Committee, and then they present it to us, because there is one out on Washington Boulevard about 17th Street. Is there a process by which candidates would come and present a project to you?
For public art?
Uh-huh.
Yes, there is. There's actually an information statement that's the very beginning that says this is what we want this project to be, and they actually fill out where, when, why, how long, you know, what type of project it is. The Arts Advisory Committee then reviews these projects. We look at the feasibility of this actually happening and the budget, long-term impact, all of these things. And then we're actually in the process, because there hasn't been any public art since the fire station piece put in of a whole bunch of projects that should be coming up for approval soon. Okay. So that we've been researching and writing up and getting permissions and things of new projects to come forward for you.
Then so you present that to the council?
Yes.
Yes.
So the distinction is this one is unique in the sense that we don't own the art. Okay, we're contributing to the art along with the other institutions in the city. Typically, when they come forward through Lori, she's given a project, or we'll put out an RFP, as we did for the fire station, or as we did for the Solstice project down on the river. Mm-hmm. Those will come through, and they'll either go out through an RFP, they're reviewed through what we used to call percent for arts, they're reviewed through the ordinances that are governed, and they're put forward by the Arts Committee. Or they're basically gone through the general fund, and those general fund are the ones that you see every year, are the number of what we have this year.
26. Those are art grants.
If you remember those, the 26 smaller art grants. Yeah. Those are the two mechanisms that you normally see in either case. So we own one side. Those are public pieces of art that we own, or they're the regular general fund contributions that we do every year.
So private properties could also present art pieces. Is that right?
Not with public art funds, usually, no, because the ordinance states that the piece of art Ogden City has to own it, or it has to be installed on Ogden City-owned property.
Okay.
Which becomes problematic. Yeah.
Okay.
But where this is actually in the public realm, easily accessible, it's not locked off or anything, this actually is in the public realm, just not on city property.
There is a portion of our ordinance that does, I can't recite it specifically, but nothing in this section shall limit the city council's ability to approve, et cetera, right? That's the exception that you're asking us to approve this under?
Special circumstances.
Right, special circumstances. For us, I mean, it's awkward because it's already done.
Yes.
It's already paid for somewhere, somehow.
Yeah, so it sounds like we're reimbursing someone's
Yes, we are actually, the funds they're asking for, the $20,000, is actually for the artist fee to paint. So we're not reimbursing, you know, any of improvements or anything like that. It's actually going to the artist.
Has she been paid? She hasn't been paid entirely?
I don't think she's been paid entirely.
There's two questions that I have that, you know, I got to say this up front. I think the thing is absolutely worthy of getting done. Mm-hmm. The problem is the process. That's where I have a hang-up. Mm-hmm. If we go ahead with this, you know, Pandora, she's got that box, and it's going to open. Are we going to have a flood of these kind of requests come through if we go this way? That just seems like it's inviting that. And, you know, we've been working to get our percent for art or art funding up over the years, and next year will be the full funding. But this actually takes it $10,000 over next year's funding. If we take our $90,000 that we've budgeted, mm-hmm. plus this 20, that goes to 110. So tell me how I can feel good about that.
So the two budgets are actually separate. So there is the percent for art money is a separate account that goes into, and then the grant money, which was the $90,000, is there.
So we took the money. It's a budget transfer, so we're grossing up the $90,000 so that we won't be over budget.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so that's coming out of the percent for arts and made under the transfer under your authority. That's why you're here. That grosses mm-hmm. out that. We won't be any less next year because of that. We're just taking the money that would go from there. let me address the Pandora box issue, which I think is one that I talked to Lori about this morning, and it was one of the ones that I anticipated as a question. It's a legitimate concern. The characteristics would have to be the same. You'd still have to basically look at a project that contributes and makes all the characteristics that this one does. So will we see more of those? Possibly. I don't know. We don't really know. But there are a number of characteristics that are very unique to this particular project that make it different than things that we've ever seen. So that's why you have the ability inside the ordinance to basically make discretionary uses of funds. And so while it could, and you know, you could have a lot of projects from around the community that might come in, they'd have to meet a certain specific set of conditions under the 10.8.2 study. That's why the study is done. If they don't meet the conditions of the study, then they wouldn't go forward. So, yeah, it's a little bit unusual, and we're looking at a little bit of an unusual situation in kicking off the Arts District, and we thought the project was worthy of helping us kick that off and what it does economically to improving the area, and that's the question that's in front of you, is if you agree.
I just have a question. I'm obviously, everybody knows I'm a huge supporter of the arts, and I love this mural, but I guess I'm thinking in my mind what people are asking or going to ask is, you know, did we commit to helping to support the project before it's approved by the city council? You know, I think that's kind of what we're at the heart asking, right?
Yeah.
And I know you're saying we were trying to look for ways to go about helping to support it, but did we ever make a commitment of any kind before this moment to fund it?
No, no commitment was made. Actually, I initially told them there was no way for me to help them. And so, and in answer to your question about opening Pandora's box, I get calls and requests all the time about, can you give us money for things? And
you're going to have a hard time saying no, though, now.
No, no, I'm not, because in the years I've been here, nothing has come up that I would actually even consider coming to you guys on the special circumstances. It doesn't happen very often. Like, it's, you know, this is not, definitely not the norm.
Well, I see the special circumstances of this, and I can feel better about it because of those. The project is worthy. That was my only real issue, is the process was kind of wonky.
Well, the process is a little different. Part of what drove us to bring it forward was the fact that we had so many partners that had contributed to the project. So that is, when we looked at what the impact was for the amount of money spent, we felt like it was a worthy project. We kept saying no because it kept getting looked at as, will you guys basically fund this? And when it was, no, we don't have a mechanism. What changed it is when we had so many different institutions basically coming on board, and we thought we ought to bring it forward for the community.
So at what point in that process did you make a decision to do the project and then ask us for the approval?
The project had already started.
Yeah. We didn't commit any funds to this at all. We're actually coming back behind. This is why it's kind of backwards, is Weber County put money in, Nature Center, Weber State University, Owen Arts. There's a bunch of partners that have come forward too. And we're kind of a little behind the game and just want to be involved within the project to show our support. It isn't that we are like going behind your backs and saying we're planning this and then coming around and bringing it to you. It is just,
and I know you better than that. I wouldn't do that. And you know how much I love the work you do. I mean, I love it. And this is clearly worthy of support, like Rich said. It just feels like you guys made our decision for us. So it's,
yeah, we have not promised anything.
What if we don't say yes? Does the artist not get paid, or
I would imagine
what are we supposed to do, you know?
The partners, I guess, would try to figure out another way to, you know, come up with the money. I'm not sure, but we haven't promised anything. This is just from the request for funding, this is where we've gotten to here. We just went through the process of writing the study and bringing it to you guys to ask if you would support.
Do we need to create a process for things like this? We've talked a little bit about that with nonprofit organizations or different things. I mean, do we need to create another?
There is a process. There is a process, and the process is no. So yeah. We're asking for the exception in this particular case based on its worthiness as a project.
I think she's asking for an additional process for major grants.
We have
especially
to
since we have a creative district, and this might continue to happen. That's all I'm asking. I understand
that process
what
is set
says.
Up through the percent for artists. So it's been established when it comes to the arts.
And so I guess just
this one didn't. So what I'm asking is, do we need to create another process?
I don't think so. If we okay. see another one like this again, I should never say never, but I don't think you'll see one like this. It's time. This is the night for exceptions.
And I guess as a follow-up to Angela's question, does this create any fairness or equity issues for the people who followed the arts grant process and had to put their applications in on time and were vetted out through the committee?
I don't imagine that this is going to create any problems because it isn't.
We haven't taken any resources out of that normal, so it doesn't create a shortage for anybody.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's in the CIP.
Yeah, we didn't take any money from them at all. Like,
yeah, I guess it's just the application process. They didn't really have to follow a process and have part of what they requested weighed out with the for other groups. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't. I really don't know, honestly, how to answer that. Like what. I mean, I guess
we didn't need it.
Potentially,
that's kind of why we came up with the question. Is it's a difficult question to answer. I think.
Well, that's why the 1082 process is in the, in that place. Is that basically is the vetting process, and we would. So let's not get confused. 1082 is not for just particularly arts projects.
Right.
We don't use the 1082 process very often. The last one we used is on 17th Street. So that's why it came in through that mechanism.
Okay.
But this
did Ogden First, did they receive an arts grant last time you offered?
I don't think
they did. I'll double check.
I think no, they didn't. They didn't get any grants this last cycle, no.
I don't remember them applying.
No, they didn't apply. Last year the last cycle they did, but they didn't this time. Do you guys have other questions about the project?
Anything for Lori? Anything else?
Yeah, they're not on the list, Bart.
Yeah. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay.
I should have had my stuff.
Is there any importance to have Ogden City's name as part of this project?
I feel like it's very important for us to show our support within a big, like, large community collaboration to show our support in the arts, as well as that it is a huge kickoff or anchor for our new creative district that we're trying to create. So that's why the six circumstances are just slightly so much more different than anything more normal that we would normally bring forward on the normal processes. So I do feel like myself, I feel like that's important, and other city members definitely feel like this is an important, that, you know, that we're showing our support to our community in these bigger projects that are going to bring a lot of attention to Ogden, but that's, you know, that's what I think, anyways.
Let me make sure I understand. So we have not committed. We
no.
We have a contract.
We have nothing.
Already given the name.
No. No, this is bringing it to you to ask if you guys would like to support the project. I know it's kind of backwards because it's already done, but it's just the way it worked out.
The project's already done. Our contribution isn't.
Yeah, we have not contributed anything and have not agreed to commit anything.
Any other comments or questions? Yeah, it flew by, didn't it?
Yes.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
So if there's comfort and interest, a possible timeline for this would be for you all to consider setting a public hearing during your meeting next week. And because this is part of the state code 1082 process, there is a bit of a lengthy time for the consideration of the art grant portion of this. There's two actions associated with this. The first is the budget amendment of the $20,000, and then the second would be the actual granting of the art grant. So I don't know if there's concern or question with that timeline.
I am happy Lisa understands it.
I think we understand it. It's just the questions I asked, is the challenges that I'm struggling with. I don't want to penalize the good work that our arts community is doing. I don't want to be bureaucratic about the approval or non-approval, but I want to make it clear that we have a part in this process too, and that that's a part of the process that we wish to exercise. So I'm conflicted, personally.
Any council business or comments before we run out of time? Okay, thanks everybody for being here. We'll adjourn to the other room.